And with me now is Salam Pax. Welcome to Fresh Air.
Hi.
Now that Saddam Hussein is out of power, what can you tell us about who you are? I know you don't want to reveal your name, and frankly, your name wouldn't mean very much to Americans anyway, yeah. So we wouldn't be likely to recognize your name. But what can you tell us about your life, your identity? And if you can't tell us much, that's fine, too. I'll leave that to your discretion.
I studied architecture. I spent almost, in total, half of my life abroad, but have been in Iraq for the last 7 years. No, it's more like 8 years. My English comes from the time I was abroad. I was in Austria. I started architecture there. I finished it in Iraq. I worked as an architect for a couple of years in Iraq before the war. I was not in Iraq during the first Gulf War. Actually, I was in Austria. And these are, you know, small little memories about that and how it happened and when we first got back to Iraq. So, that's basically it. I mean, yeah.
And how old are you?
I'm 30. I'm going to be 30 in a couple of days.
During the war, what did you think the risks were if your identity was discovered?
I'd be hanging from a ceiling somewhere. What happened at the first week of the war? You know these satellite phones. They were tracking people down who were communicating through these satellite phones, putting them on TV, calling them traitors, and they're going to get executed. They basically were going after every single person who was, in a way, giving information to the outside world, saying what's happening, because, you know, they're going into war and every bit of information might be of some importance. I didn't realize that right at the beginning. I was writing, there is this 1 week at the beginning of the war where the internet did not go down, where we still had internet and I was posting. And I was writing about all the places I was going to, what I saw there, what the bombing was like. And then I saw that on TV and I'm thinking, this is not good. I was seriously worried. And besides, there was on BBC World Service and Voice of America a report about the weblog. And that was actually the scariest time I've ever had. It was this 2 weeks before everything totally fell apart and I was sure that they're never going to track me down because the internet is down, they're worried about other things. But the first 2 weeks of the war, they were looking for people and I was really, really worried.
One of the amazing things about your story is that not only did the Saddam Hussein authorities know who you were, your parents didn't know who this web logger was. Your family had no idea that you were that guy. How did you manage to keep it a secret from your own family?
Oh, it's, that's the beauty of, doing things on a computer, on the internet. Nobody has to know anything. You're sitting there and you have, a couple of windows open. One of them is work. One of them is something on the internet. And the other one is the blogging site. And yeah, I'd write stuff all the time. And of course, when they found out, my father would go, so this is why you're spending so much time in front of your computer. It's not very difficult. You just don't talk about it. You make sure that you do not talk about it. There is only one friend, Raed. The site is called Where's Raed. And he knew about it. He used to read it all the time. He's in Jordan.
So did your family feel like you had endangered them by writing your blog?
Yeah. Uh-huh. Yeah. There was a moment of... Of course, they only found out a couple of weeks after the war started, because that's when the BBC thing went on. So, there was a moment where that you could have gotten us all in serious trouble. You know that this was very, very dangerous, and we were all just very lucky, which is true, which is very, very, very true. It was very reckless. It was sometimes foolish. It's just you get carried away. There's this space where you can say what you want to say. and you just do it. It's this you know, outlet. You can talk there. People respond to you, and so.
You mentioned in your writing that there were points where you felt like your readers knew more about what you were thinking and feeling than your family did, because you were writing all this stuff in your blog.
Yeah.
And of course, you know, you weren't telling it to your family, and they didn't know that the blog was written by you.
No, I mean, they didn't even read it. They didn't mm-hmm. know about it. Mm-hmm. I mean, blogging in general. I've been reading all these people for a very long time before I started blogging, and they put all these things about their lives, and it feels like they're sharing with you. They're telling you what's happening with their lives. They're giving you little, very, you know, sometimes intimate glimpses into their lives. And at one point, when I decided I start my own blog, it's you kind of give back some of what they gave you. It was wonderful reading them. It was like you get to know other worlds. And yes, I did put a lot on the weblog, consciously thinking, this, I'm sharing, you know, my little world with all these people from whom I've learned so much, or just, you know, got to see other parts of the world, of other lives through these weblogs. And that's what it was in the beginning. It was really just bloggers. It doesn't feel like you're writing now, like all these people reading the columns and coming online to read the weblog. It was much smaller. You don't feel you're giving too much away, because it's like having a conversation on a really big table where every, you know, you get a chance to talk and everybody listens and someone else starts talking and you listen. And it was just this big table where everybody was telling stories.
Right, but you felt more exposed once it got into newspapers.
Of course. I mean, some of the stuff, I mean, when I read it now, it's funny to know that all these people would know so much about your life.
Salam, has anyone in your family been hurt in the war or the post-war?
During the war, there was this one incident where our neighborhood got... there was, on the main street, there was a convoy going by, and we had a couple of Baathists sitting at the end of the street in an empty house, and I think one of them shot something at the convoy. The convoy stops, they go back, and one tank stays, and it shoots something like 20, you know, tank shells towards the block where we live. Luckily, no one got hurt, but this was actually... It was after the war. It was after the statue fell. It's very scary having... It's so close. In the end, we had three houses in the block were totally destroyed. One house burned. Our house, some damage. Two girls got hurt. But luckily, no one died. It was just a very, very... So this was really the most dangerous time we had. The thing is, we live in a not in the center of Baghdad. We live, you know, quite a bit far away from the center. There is nothing near us. And what we did is that we got all the family to come over to where we live. At one point, I think we had something like, you know, 25 people living in our house, because it was pretty safe. There was nothing around it. So we'd just go and check on friends and relatives in places where it was, you know, they did get bombed. But we were lucky. We were really lucky there.
And do you have a lot of friends or family who lost their homes?
Oh, yeah. I mean, look, during the beginning of the war, the especially in Baghdad, the air raids, you would be amazed just how... I mean, precision bombing is just scarily precise. It's just incredibly precise. And as long as you don't live near one of the government buildings or Saddam's palaces, which nobody does anyway, you are actually very safe. I mean, stay in your house, don't go out. We were worried more about the Iraqis than the bombers, you know. Okay, there'll be stray bombs going here and there, and they'd get false information. But it's actually the bombing part of the war was was pretty. It wasn't as frightening as think as the time when the actual troops were coming into Baghdad.
What made that part more frightening?
You didn't know what will happen. I mean, the first nights of the bombing, of course, this was the same. There was fear, uncertainty. You did not know what is going to happen. When you hear the air raid sirens, your brains just stop functioning. There is just fear. And you keep listening. You just keep listening what's happening. And then you hear them drop somewhere. It's like, poof, big explosion. And then another one comes, and another one comes. The first two, and then, next morning, me and my cousin would go and see where the places the bombs dropped and everything and look at them. And you kind of start realizing, no, you are not afraid of the, big bombers. You're worried about the Iraqis, the Iraqi army, what it would do. There were all these rumors about getting all the men in the city, to carry weapons and pushing them out to fight, lots of uncertainty.
What precautions did you take in your house to protect against the armies and to protect against, possible chemical or biological warfare and to protect against the bombing in case there was a stray bomb?
Yeah, this was actually part of the good part of the weblog where people would tell me about, give me tips on things. And for example, everybody was drilling these, wells. The water table in Baghdad is pretty high, so it's not very hard to get, small well. And everybody was doing this because we were worried that the water would stop at one point. So I went on the weblog and I was telling, people what we were doing and how I, finally convinced my family that we actually need to drill a well. And I got all these responses of people telling me how to make sure that how deep I should go and how to make sure that the water is usable, which is actually very helpful. And then we had to dig, very deep holes in the garden and stock gas and kerosene for the generator. We had to, because all the family was coming over to our house, we had to make it looks like a bit like a hotel, actually. It was funny at a point.
You called it Hotel Pax in your blog.
Yeah, because there's so many people coming. It was good. It is so good to have so many people around you in difficult situations. It just takes, lunch becomes a huge production. It's like everybody has to do this and that, and you have to prepare food for so many people. It gets your mind off things you don't want to think of.
Salam, is liberated the right word to describe how your country feels to you now?
Of course. But you see, when you say liberation, there is with it a feeling that there should be a huge sigh of relief. The problem is, at the moment, we still didn't have this, collective, oh God, it's over. Because people, it's still difficult. The day will come, I am sure. There's this one, hour and a half when I'm sure everybody's seen it, when they were pulling down the statue of Saddam.
Mm-hmm.
And it was at that point, yes, this was the moment, was everybody, we were sitting in front of TV. We didn't have electricity. We had to run the generator because we were getting, someone from the end of the street, a neighbor was going, turn on your TVs, look what's happening. So we turn on the TVs and you see this and you're thinking, oh my God. My aunts were going, no way anybody thought this is going to happen in our lifetime, and we're just totally dumbstruck. This is amazing. Of course, you are optimistic at that point, but things started getting a bit more difficult, and you start to worry. It was just as the troops were moving into Baghdad, and there was still this uncertainty about what was going to happen. Yes, I would say we are freer now, of course, and we are definitely moving on the right way to a truly free, liberated Iraq. It's just going to take a bit of time. We need patience.
What kind of encounters have you been having in your daily life with U.S. soldiers who are stationed in Iraq and trying to keep the peace there?
Oh, all sorts, all sorts. It's
give us an example of a good and a bad one, if there is
yeah,
such.
Yeah,
yeah.
I mean, a good one would be right. I think it was the second week when they were in Baghdad, and they weren't very. The Americans weren't sure about the people, and the people in Baghdad weren't sure about the Americans. But then slowly, I'd have a cousin who went back to his home because it was a bit safer by then, and at the end of his street, the Americans had a just a small station where a couple of tanks and they were staying there, they weren't so afraid of Iraqis as they are now. He'd come back to me and tell me about, them letting him take a look at the tank inside, and they would come over and actually have lunch at his place. It was at the beginning, the first couple of weeks, you'd hear lots of this, some actual true interaction between the Iraqis and the Americans in Baghdad. It's only later on they withdrew a bit more. There was this fear that things aren't as stable as everybody hopes. And at that point, you'd get your the thing you just called a bad example, because they come over from thousands of miles away. They have no idea what the culture is like. This comes across as hostility. It's maybe just, they just sometimes you get the feeling that they don't know how things go. And they just act the way they see it's normal, but it's sometimes offensive to Iraqis.
Well, can you think of an example that happened to you where you felt that an American or a British soldier misinterpreted a kind of standard thing, because they didn't understand the culture and they responded inappropriately to what they had seen?
During house raids.
What are house raids?
Oh, because they'd raid a whole neighborhood and check for weapons and go into houses, check what is in the house, who is in the house. And they do this throughout. I mean, it was everywhere in Iraq and Baghdad and other governorates that just go into neighborhoods, block them off, and go into houses. So it's, if anything bad is going to happen, it's going to happen there during these raids. It's at night. People are just, suddenly you have someone banging at your door and, they want to go into your house. They don't come with enough translators sometimes, which is a bad thing. So someone comes out who doesn't really speak the language. I mean, both of them, neither the soldier speaks Arabic nor the Iraqi speaks English. And you have them standing at the door. Now the Iraqi has his, for example, daughter and wife sitting in the room just behind the door, just behind him, without hijab, without, their head cover or the abaya. And, I mean, because they do this in these very simple or very religious places, you have to be very careful. So the man outside is trying to explain, do not come in because, my wife, my daughter, whoever, needs to cover herself. I mean, a stranger shouldn't be looking at her if she hasn't covered her hair. It's just, that's the way her belief is. So, of course, he cannot bring this across to the soldier because he doesn't speak English. The soldier doesn't understand this. What he understands is that someone is pushing him away. And so he thinks, he doesn't want me into his house, something is wrong. Down he goes, sack on his head, tie his hand, put a gun on his head, and he's, starts shouting at him, things the Iraqi does not understand anyway. Now the women come out and they see their, father or husband down on the ground, and everybody starts wailing and going, and you have a scene. And it creates, lots of tension. It's down to communication. It's down to understanding. this is, you know, lots of it comes down to these things, not being able to understand just simple things. Going into a mosque with your shoes, a big no-no. Just, you don't do it. And sometimes they just go back, 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 and they see them in there. Oh my God, what are you doing with your shoes on?
Was your house ever raided by soldiers?
Yeah, yeah, it was. It was.
What was your experience like? You speak English, so the translation thing.
No, it was. Yeah, it was actually. It was much easier for. I mean, it was scary. I wasn't at home. My mother was actually a bit freaked out. I wasn't at home, so I came back the other day and the next day, and they were telling me, you know, the Americans were here and they've been through the house and everything. Yeah, because everybody was able to talk to everybody else, like my father, my brother, and my mother. It's like everybody was making sure that they understood there is nothing in here. You shouldn't be afraid of anything. There were no problems. It's just the point of being very uncomfortable. I mean, you have 20 people suddenly at 12 o'clock at night climbing over your fence, you know, with guns pointing at you, telling you to come out of your house because you want to look through it. So it's just this point which is a bit uncomfortable. And they wouldn't tell you why or what happened, so what have you done wrong. So no, they just want to do it. And of course, because you're talking to them, the hour they spent there wasn't probably as tough as if it would have been somewhere else. It's not always like this. When they have translators around with them, it's no problem.
You have one of your entries in your weblog in which you wrote about watching Paul Bremer on the news every night. And you said it was like watching Saddam Hussein, you know, because he's all over. He's always making statements. You said, next we'll have statues of him in the street. And then you added you didn't believe him either. Is there a general feeling now that the American interim administration has problems of credibility and communication problems,
yeah,
like the actual, yeah, Iraqi government did before?
Yeah. They are in their, they call it the green zone, which means, you know, the safe zone. It's the old palace grounds. It's just, you know, it's just, you bring up the wrong associations. You wall yourself in again in the same place. You are not as transparent as everybody was hoping. And sometimes you say things which feel like you're on another planet. It comes down again to communication. They are in this green zone. They're afraid to go out and see people, see what they're doing, see how they're living. They do things. I am sure there's a lot happening. I'm not only sure, I know there's a lot happening, but not things that people feel like they're changing the daily lives with. Is something that's on a much higher level. It's very slow. It takes lots of time. You don't see it. But it's not coming down to them. They're not. Nobody's communicating with them. Nobody's telling. The only thing they see is, you know, Bremer on TV talking a foreign language, looking really nice and neat, very clean. And, you know, it's just the same images. You end up, you click the channel. We now, at least now, we have satellite TV. We don't have to watch that.
You know, all the reports I've been hearing about life in Iraq now make it sound really anarchic, with lots of crime and still looting. When you go out in the streets, do you do anything to protect yourself or even to arm yourself?
No, you don't arm. But and I mean, it's not as now, it's not as crazy as it was a month after the war.
Mm-hmm.
And I mean, businesses are back, banks are back, buses, taxis, the streets are full of cars. Of course, you have these crazy things happening we didn't have before. Like the other day on Karada Street, there was this man, you know, on the street with his, you know, leg just couple of meters away, and when you ask, they tell you, oh, there was a hand grenade in his pocket. It's like, what's he doing with a hand grenade? Or you'd hear too much shooting at night. But it's not total anarchy anymore. Iraqi police are on the streets. They're replacing the American soldiers we had. Life is a little bit normal. I mean, up to something like 4 p.m., it looks very normal. And then later, you see the streets emptying, people close shops pretty early. We have this 11 o'clock curfew, but you can see the streets are just as empty as anything after 8 p.m.
Do you have any do you have any money? Are you working?
Yeah, I mean, look, most...
Well, you probably got money from your book advance, so...
No, look, I mean, personally, the place where I used to... I mean, the architectural place where I used to work in, the consultancy, they're not open again yet. I mean, they're open, but they're doing nothing.
Mm-hmm.
And that's what most people do. You know, civil servants, government employees, they just go, you know, sit for a couple of hours and go back to their homes. I mean, at least they're getting paid. That's very good, because the first couple of months they were not.
Mm-hmm.
So this is one of the things that are missing, just a general sense of purpose that you're doing something with your life. It's just, at the moment, the whole country has come to a standstill. We're kind of living off charity. So it gets to you sometimes, yeah.
No, in your blog, you make it seem like you didn't really want to come back to Iraq to live. You'd been living in Vienna, where you went to school and worked, and you'd lived there during part of your childhood because your father was working there.
Yeah.
So anyways, you didn't want to come back to Iraq, but you say that your parents really wanted you to come back. Can you talk about why they wanted you to come back and how you felt upon returning?
It's not wanting to come back. It's just when you spend, you know, when you're 15, 16, 17, 18 in one place, you kind of get seriously attached to it. These are the years where, you know, you make your friends, you just...
Mm-hmm.
So when I first got to Baghdad, it was... I felt just as a stranger. I haven't been there for quite a while, and I was used to other ways. But you kind of rediscover your Iraqiness pretty quickly.
Mm-hmm.
With a little help from friends, you just get really attached to the place. It's really funny, but I got serious, you know, I really loved the city, Baghdad, because it's different when you spend all your life in a place and then when you go away and come back to it and kind of rediscover all this in a very, because you've seen something else and, you know, kind of now you can appreciate what you had much more. And it's just very different. It is very different. It's not perfect. It's not something that, there are lots of things I don't approve of that I would wish were different, but you kind of, you know, this is my city. It grows on you in ways which just totally, you get very attached to it.
If President Bush came to you, if you knew what you knew now and you were able to turn back the clock, and President Bush came to you and said, well, should we go into Iraq or not?
Oh, God, that's a difficult question.
Yeah, what would you have told him?
Be a little bit more patient. Don't run into it like you did. Iraqis know that they need foreign intervention to get rid of Saddam, but we also need to feel that it's not about... and we need to feel it's that more of an effort the world wants to do to get, you know, rid of that bad regime. The way it was done gives just too much chance to people to come and say, look, this is just American imperialism. Look what they're doing. You're giving a chance for the, you know, bad people to say bad things. You're giving them so much chance to do that.
You were reluctant to return to Iraq from Vienna. Is this the place you want to be now?
I'm almost talking to my friend Raed, who is now in Baghdad, every day, and I just cannot wait until they let me loose here and I just go back to Baghdad. I just miss the place so much.
When you're talking to us from London now.
Yeah.
And you're in London because your new book, which collects
your
blog entries,
has
come out. Yeah. So, yeah. And you're writing for The Guardian now, that you're keeping a blog for them. You probably could have a life in England or the United States, but you prefer to go back to
How can you leave a place which is first your country, mm-hmm. and second going through this
right.
very important turn? You know, this is now something that history will forever, you know, talk about in your country, and this you are so lucky to be part of it. You can be part of it. You can, you know, do something amazing now and see it happen, see it develop. Of course I have to be there. Of course I have to be there.
Salam Pax, thank you very, very much for talking with us.
Thank you.
Salam Pax's weblog about life in Baghdad before, during, and after the war is about to be published in book form in the U.S. under the title Salam Pax.